We could stop and read right there.
Okay, we'll reconvene.
So Andrew McLeod and Andrew Benson for Transpower. You've heard from us on a number of occasions and we're clearly going to seek to avoid repetition wherever possible today. That includes dealing with in detail the National Policy Statement on Electricity Transmission and the National Environmental Standards on Electricity Transmission Activities. But it is important to note that it's the relationship between the proposed district plan and these documents that is the primary focus of Transpower's mission and also my evidence. Before I hand over to Mr. Renton, I'd perhaps just briefly clarify the role of those documents, because I consider there might have been some confusion in the evidence and submissions you've received from Aurora in relation to the role of those documents. The NPS, first and foremost, includes an objective and accompanying policies that seek to enable the national grid while managing the effects of and the effects on the national grid. The proposed district plan must give effect to that. The NES includes a suite of regulations that provide for works on existing transmission lines only. The NES doesn't include provisions for new transmission lines, and it doesn't establish separation distances from transmission lines. And I think in some of the evidence from Aurora, there's been a suggestion that the NES is a driver for some of those matters. So I just wanted to clarify that in the first instance. We can now go to Mr. Renton, who can summarise the technical matters that relate to the release sought by Transpower.
Thank you very much. So I'm just going to run through, when I say my evidence, I'll just pull out the high points.
Yes.
I've had a couple of extra examples produced for you just to help us do that. But the three major things I want to run through was just confirming the assets that we have, what works we do or require to do on those assets, and then we can close up with items about earthworks and choose the EPR that you might have other questions on. So in terms of our assets, we look at that piece of paper that I provided you. The very bottom of it shows the 110kV double circuit transmission line that runs from Cromwell to Frankton. That is the only line into this part of the world, and Frankton substation is our only substation to Queenstown. So all the power supply for Queenstown comes from that, what we call a predictor point. Currently has a capacity of about 80 megawatts, and demand coming out of there at the moment is around 58. It was recently upgraded about 5 years ago when we put a new indoor switch board there and increased the transformer capacity out of the site.
I take it from the Cromwell substation,
yeah.
There's the critics of point also that Aurora uses for the Wanakamai.
Correct.
Yes.
So following along the line, we've got 128 structures, towers, you've got a pole that runs basically over the back of Bannockburn, down through Gippsland Valley and into Frankton. Later on we'll talk about, and it's covered in Aitken's evidence, the definition of the corridor and the yard, but the middle suite of pictures that you see here is the transmission line in red, that's the centre line of the line, and the slightly yellow strip by the side of it is the 12 metre distance, what we call the yard. That's what we don't want things directly under the line. That's the area, as you can see displayed. And we can tell you how many buildings are under there or not. And you can see that there's one on the right hand side, a vineyard, it's like a shed, garage or something. On the left hand side, as you come into Frankton, the last few structures, that's that part of the industrial estate just there that's established in the 80s, that part of the world. And the one in the middle, which people normally are upset about, is a nice subdivision that we worked there at Shriver Estates there, and that's fine. There's no houses or anything underneath it. It might be the old piece of property, but you seem to work quite well with the developer. It goes straight through. We can get to the towers and get to the lines and do any of the maintenance work. We're not over anybody's houses, etc. and so forth. So,
probably a school playing field.
Yeah, and walkways in between. So,
yeah, and I heard the application for the Brightstar development, which was to the east of Lake Hayes and it runs through there, and I understood that Transurban was happy with the separations.
Yeah, so it's the same.
So I understand that in the new areas there's no problems.
Correct, and what we're really looking for out of it going forward is to make sure we keep this positive thinking going so that we don't have problems either now or in the future, and most importantly we don't foreclose the ability for other people to develop what they need to make Queenstown better, and likewise the ability for us to actually provide the power that they need to be able to do that. So there's no risen infrastructures in here, and there's just those six industrial structures over there that we're going. So what is the types of works that we do? So if we talk about the line first, there's an annual patrol that we walk along the line and inspect every tower. There is then every 6 to 8 years, there is a climbing patrol where every tower is climbed and every attachment is inspected. There's a routine condition assessment procedure done every couple of years to make sure we're tracking condition and corrosion works. And any works that are identified that need doing, for example, it could range from lightning strike damage to some unfortunate person trying to take pot shots at insulators on transmission lines, so the insulators need to be replaced, or shackles might corrode or something like that. Things that need to be replaced. We're in the central target, so things don't need painting that often, but they are on the schedule for painting those towers when we get to it, so there'll be a bit of sandblasting of towers or replacements of bits of steel in the future, but it's projected about 25 years out based on condition assessment at the moment. So we need to obviously get to each tower. Area around the base of each tower to set up for sandblasting and replacing things. If we need to do any work on the tower, you need to have cranes to it and those types of things. So getting access to each spot and along the line is important. I've got photos of that type of work that you need in my previous evidence, so I haven't repeated it here. The only other major piece of work that we might need to do here in terms of maintenance is foundation works. That's, you need to expose the foundations every so many years, depending where you are, check the seals all right, mitigate it if required, and then you backfill all up the concrete and bury it back under the ground again. So you do need to go to the base of each tower into the footing. Apart from our work in terms of operations and maintenance, we do work for others. So others might include the local council, NZTA, or a landowner. So we're doing, as mentioned in my evidence, a number of property developers or people in and around Auckland. We've moved lines for people in Christchurch, so we actually have to physically move a structure because they're wanting to develop their property in some way, or the road needs to be widened. And that's not a problem, but we just need to be able to get access to it. We need to get access to the spot. We need to be able to move the line. The reason I mention that is the reference to the council's plan. It's good to be able to see where sensitive land uses are, or features outstanding landscapes that the week official for us, of course, is if the line's already there, we're not going to reroute the entire line if we've only got to move a tower or a pole or something a few hundred metres or 50 metres or 10 metres. So some works that we do, say like in the Gibson Valley, because it's a very nice part of the countryside, if one of the vineyards needs something moved, or Mr. Hackett wants to improve his bungee jumping things, then and he needs us to be out of the way, well, we'll certainly accommodate it, we'll pay for it, we'll move it. But we do need a place allowed for, all the rules allowed for us in the plan, that we're allowed to physically move the structure, because it's not going to go anywhere else but back in the same outstanding landscape, but maybe 20 or 30 or 50 metres away. So those are the types of work that we do. If we talk about the corridor that we talk about in the yard, if you go to page 27, you can see a picture of what we mean. It shows the DC line, but the concept is what's important. And that is, under a nice day like today with no wind, the conductors, the wires will just hang straight down. But when the wind blows, the conductors move sideways. And this is showing quite a windy day through central Otago and north Canterbury. through north Canterbury. But it's not unusual. So the 12 metres, why we've got 12 metres on the 110 kV line for the yard, is that when the wind blows a little bit up to 40 kilometres an hour, and at that point we pull people out of the towers, we don't let them work, it's wind speeds greater than 40 kilometres an hour. At 40 kilometres an hour, the conductors might move up to 12 metres sideways. So ideally we don't have anything underneath those, so that's 12 metres either side of the centre line, and that's what we call the yard. But in the wider corridor, as the wind blows stronger, they could blow further out. In the case of the 110 lines here, we're talking about 32 metres on the longer spans. Now, 12 metres, we don't want anybody under there, but between 12 and 32, we don't mind there being something there at all. What we want to be able to do is have the conversation that, are you putting a 30-storey building there, in which case the wires will hit it, or are you going to put a single-storey dwelling there, or are you going to put a two-storey dwelling there? Or is it going to be, because it's a vineyard, you're going to put up a windmill to blow the frost, frost wave along the warm area. So it's just a matter of understanding so that they don't get caught out later and have to rectify it. And that kind of goes nicely to a link to things with works. And in my evidence, I've got some pictures, which is good. So if we look at page 10 and page 11.
Who's in that photo? Is that someone that was acting curiously, or has it got compliant?
On page 11, this one.
Yes.
Yep, that was a farmer for the best of intentions wanting to flatten his paddock for a centre pivot. And he looked up in the NZP34, worked out what he needed to do, and he just went ahead and did it. And that's okay, right? He was doing, as he perceived it, all the right things, because that's what it said. He was being proactive and all those good things. But it does kind of very much highlight the limitations of just blindly applying NZP34.
Can you
centre
pivot
around? So that was just finding light towards the edge and the end, and it's trying to get things driving through and towing them and all sorts of things. But anyway, he did that, and it's, yes, it works, yes, it complies with the letter of the what's going on. Unfortunately, the bottom of that pole is in terms of the foundation is about where the bottom of the ladder is, right? So as that mound of dirt gradually gets washed away, it just highlights matters earthworks. Compliance of NZC34 does not by and of itself mean that everything's okay. The picture on page 10 was one in a subdivision directly which we've shown before, but again, in that case, they didn't even know that they had to comply. In which case, they just kept excavating back to the tower, and that was okay with them, because there was no trigger for them to come and talk to us.
On a neuron, but
no.
Fast and said, this is big tall structure.
No. And you know, I don't know everything about subdivisions and building houses and roads and stuff like that, right? So
they usually have engineers involved
So earthworks in and around our structures are interesting. Page 12 and 13 show a place up in Hastings. Now, we've just finished the mitigations here, and the reason that we're interested in making sure the plans ensure that there is a conversation held early, so that, because everything's solvable, right? What's happened here in Hastings is they've built their house with a lovely fine vista and view, they put their roadway in and built a beautiful sweeping drive, and unfortunately, on photo on page 12, photo 4, they built the ground up underneath the wires, because the wires are normally high here, but they calculated to sag down when they're running hard, right? Well, the landowner doesn't do that. Anyway, he was breaching by a couple of metres. So the mitigation is he's had to go back and he's had to establish with all his suppliers, and they've had to dig out the driveway and reseal it and all that type of stuff. All things that could have been avoided if it had just been done bigger.
What's the yellow thing on the left hand side of the
photo? So that's what we have as a live line stick. So the line is actually running, it's an insulated stick that's good for 110 kV, because that's what that line's good for. So we can get a really accurate measurement without having to get the helicopter out and fly it with laser gear. But that just was to prove to the landowner, this is what it is, this is where it will go to.
And the 110 kV, the electricity will come down to the ground at that point.
Well, because there's enough insulation in that stick, it doesn't get to the ground.
Right.
But we were just measuring it, showing it. He didn't believe that the conductor was at that height, so he just had to. So we took our live line gear out that we use and put it underneath and physically measured it and said, and it will come lower when we're running it hard on a hot day.
And you believe Ferguson is right because he was all the
scared. We're completely okay with that sort of stuff, so we're okay with that.
Okay.
So that was photo 4 and photo 5, and then for the same house, poor guy. Photo 6, we have a pole, right? Now, again, NZECP 34 says you've got to be a minimum distance away based on the depth of excavation and stuff. So he thought our pole was a great way of retaining his wall. So, again, he had to rip out. So, in effect, all that stuff you see there, where he's got his trailer park and his retaining wall and all that earthworks that he built up to have this nice driveway and a turning circle, he's had to rip all of that out. And we could have solved all of that if there was just a trigger in his plan to make sure he came and saw us, to make sure, because NZECP 34 exists and it's mandatory, but there's no trigger to it, right? And it does bring us nicely to, if you look at this little picture, what I've done is, these are all dimensions out of NZECP 34, depending on how you interpret it. So the one on the left hand side shows the height that conductors need to be as a minimum based on the span length. Now, unless you're the landowner who reads the right part, you might get a bit confused there, but the one that's really a challenge is this one on the right hand side showing the garage. Now, it's the same garage and the same person standing on the roof, but there's two different heights ultimately. One's at 7.5 metres and one's at 9.5 metres or thereabout. And the difference between the two is if you come and talk to us and we do the design work checks and we make sure that what you're planning on doing, we're sure you're not going to get into trouble, we'll reduce the clearance required from 9.5 metres down to being something like 7.5 metres, or we could. But you will note there's this little piece I've put in here that says flashover, we dotted line, and you're, so at 110 kV, the electricity will arc over a distance of 1.5 metres. So if you kind of add the numbers up, 2.4 metres plus the height of this garage, we pretended to be 3 metres, and so forth, you can see that there's only half a metre of difference, right, which is where this, we need to be sure about the engineering, and we need to be sure you're confident about what you're doing, because if you're just walking along the roof inspecting it, that's not a problem. If you're planning on painting the roof or changing the roofing iron, and you're going to be
a fishing rod?
Yeah, right.
And use short tradesmen.
Yeah, I mean, you could. So all of these are numbers that are in NZECP 34. Mm-hmm. So just saying comply with it could get into sticky business, and it's not, although it's mandatory to comply, there is no way of linking the building part and the consenting part to this, unless there's something in the plan. It might not be the perfect thing, but I'm in the business of trying to keep the lights on and make sure that people don't get killed.
But the difference of 2.5 metres on the between the span, just make them all 10 metres and be done with it.
Seems simple. We're trying to make sure that we give as much freedom for the community to be able to build what it needs to do. Otherwise, you get kind of smacked with the big domineering organisation is Land Grab in Britain. So we could take your suggestion, Mr Sinclair, and say Mr Sinclair said it's a good idea. Yeah. So that's earthworks. Now there is one little thing which I'll let Ainsley talk about the details about, because I don't know them so well, but earthworks, as I understand it when I had a look at the plan, has a certain definition that kind of excludes offal pits. Now, offal pits aren't all themselves normally a problem, except we have had problems where people have dug their offal pit closer to our pole than NZCP 34 would allow if they were digging a hole for any other reason other than an offal pit. To the pole and the transmission lines, a hole in the ground is a hole in the ground. A hole in the ground filled with dead animals or water or something is no different to just a hole in the ground. So Ainsley can get to the specifics and details, but I did ask that you need to be careful with how that's arranged, because we could get in the unfortunate situation where somebody was doing a road or doing digging a hole for some other thing, they'd have to come and see us. But the way that the rules were drafted at the moment, they might be able to go away and just dig a huge awful bit right next to a transmission tower, and then we might wind up with the transmission tower in the hole rather than. So I don't quite know how all the details work, but I'll leave that to Ainsley.
Fortunately, I don't think there's any kids from going.
No. What was that cool stuff from the left over grates? The press
mark.
Yeah. Do they have big mark pits or something? Turn into compost.
They wouldn't used to do it in the pits, they do it on ground. At ground
level?
Yeah.
As long as they don't build big heaps underneath the.
Well, they would, yeah, things. It's not Marlborough down here.
Ah, right.
It's probably okay.
Can I ask why the distinction with offal pits?
Do you recognise that? Well, I can do it now.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. Can deal with that. So the rules in the revised chapter include rules that restrict earthworks in the National Grid Yard, but the rules refer to earthworks, and then there's an operative definition of earthworks in the plan that excludes certain things, including poles for tree planting and offal pits. On that basis, Transpower's submission sought a specific definition for earthworks in the National Grid Yard to capture the same type of earthworks that would occur, that is captured by ECP 34. So there's a consistency between district plan regulations and ECP 34. The 42A report has said that with most of the things, you'd be digging a hole to build a structure or a building, and therefore those activities would still be captured under the Buildings and Structures National Grid Yard rules. I don't think that would be the case for significant tree planting where there were big holes near a National Grid structure or for offal pits. So there's still a gap in the regulation, if you like, compared to what ECP 34 might do and the definition of earthworks in the plan. You can't resolve the definition of earthworks in the plan except for to include a specific definition for earthworks in the National Grid Yard.
Did Transpower put in a general submission on that definition, or only to seek the specifics for the transmission corridors?
Only to seek a specific definition for earthworks in the National Grid Yard.
Right.
Yeah. On the basis that the earthworks definition itself is operative, I understand, and therefore not part of this proposed.
No. The earthworks chapter is
operative. Yes. I thought that chapter 2 had operative and not operative definitions. I may be wrong.
No, they're all
proposed. Yeah, are there any other submissions? So that part of it that might allow us.
Well, in fact, we're not getting new definitions until March of
So that's something that we can look at.
Yes, we can look at that.
Yes, and we certainly can look at that, because, you know, it seems like a bit of overkill to have a specific earthworks in the National Grid Yard definition, but that was certainly the relief sought. Mm. That said, the predicament is set out in a bit more detail and the reason. So there may be adequate scope.
And to be fair, if anyone was going to be majorly affected by it, it would be Aurora.
Yes.
Compared to Transpower. They
yes.
have many more poles in the rural areas.
That's true.
I don't look after Aurora's asset, so make sure the lights stay on.
That's what you have to do with that arrangement.
So that kind of covers off those items. That brings us down to the substation.
Yes.
So the substation has transformers and circuit breakers and a few other big bits of equipment. Details of that are in the back of my evidence. If you want to pull out it more, you can. Really, we get down to two things at substations, and one is noise, which we try and limit. There are certain things that you can and cannot limit. When circuit breakers go off, it sounds like a shotgun, but they happen very frequently. There are no circuit breakers presently installed at Frankton, just because of the size of the site. They could go in the future. And then there's transformers, so the underlying hum that you hear from a transformer, there will be good fans or pumps are running. Now we do have to comply with numbers on the boundary, so 45 dBA at night normally on the boundary, 45 dBA penalty, so it's all kind of whatever suits the district plan, we'll hit those numbers. However, as we found when we've worked with property developers, as towns get larger, Highport is a recent example. People who have not lived there and the substation's been here all the time and then moved there obviously have different expectations about things. So it's a case of working out what we need to do to make sure that their lives can go on as uninterrupted as possible. Again, it's catching things early. So we work with those types of developers. We've done things like making sure that there was suitable setback, possibly that bedrooms weren't pointing directly at the substation, earth plumb walls, landscaping, and a few other bits and pieces like that to try and catch it down, and then the use of our requesting activity to help to make sure that people are aware of that. And then probably the final item that really pops up, and you'll see that in this one, is that we've got our site with this boundary around it, and we've asked for a 45 metre setback around that, and that's for a EPR contour. Now, I don't know how much you want to get into the technical stuff, I don't know what your legal or technical understanding is, but basically it's a way of making sure that any development around the substation is not prevented, but to make sure that electrically what they're proposing to do is safe. So when a fault occurs at the substation, for that brief 1 second, half a second, the voltage around the station rises, and you can imagine it like a topographical map. And what we do is we make sure from an engineering perspective that things like what we call the step voltage, so the voltage on the ground that's between your legs, isn't so large that it's driving a current up through your body and through your heart. So that's the step voltage. And that the touch voltage, when you get an electric shock, so the current, if you're touching it with your fence or something, you're touching that and it goes through your arm and through the heart and down through the leg. So it's another one, it's the touch voltage. We make sure that that's all good and fine. So anything in, on and around our substations for those are all great. The trick is, the one's called transfer voltage, right? And this is, if you can imagine, a metal water pipe or a fence line. So within the substation, if we had a piece of string between us and you were the substation and I was blowing my way up this end, if the voltage rises at your end, and this piece of metal that we hold between us will go up to the level that you're holding it, but I will be far further away, so we have a lower voltage, so there will be this difference between the two of us, so I could get a shock. We obviously don't want that. So when anything transfers through an EPR zone, what you want to do is make sure that it's managed to a level that is okay. And the magic numbers are 650 and 430 volts for telecommunications equipment and 1500 volts and 2500 volts. And that's for the insulation on cable. it's really just a catch on planning thing to make sure that this thing works. So you don't put metal water pipes through things. You don't have metal fences running from a substation out to somewhere else. What you do is you make sure there's a fence, that there's isolating grates, you don't use a metal pipe, use a plastic pipe. It's all simple stuff, and all modern telecommunications cables are insulated up to a much higher voltage level these days than what they were historically. The trick is to make sure that everybody does this and keeps doing it so that nobody in the future does something silly.
So the setback procedure is not actually a limitation on their ability to use the property.
No.
That's only a limitation on certain aspects of that use, if you like.
Yeah, well,
and the materials used.
That's probably all the arrangement of them. So you could still put a metal fence in, right? If you go out to Frankton Substation there south, you'll see that it's a post and wire wire mortar and timber post fence. You'll also see that along it there are strainer posts where the wires don't touch. So in effect those little sections are broken up so that the voltage between one end and the other never gets high enough to be a step or touch issue. You'll note that there's possibly timber sections of the fence where there's timber post and rail put in. That does that thing. Sometimes we just put little insulating eggs in. And all that's doing is saying that yes, you can still have a wire fence, but we're breaking it up so that the voltage between one end of that piece of wire and the other end isn't high enough to give you a shock. Likewise, that there's no extra water pipes possibly going through there. So the trick is seeing it early and making sure that what you want them to do, you're doing it with the right materials arranged in the right way, that something's not going to become a problem to any of us. And you can see that right now with the development on the other side of the road. You've got a substation, you've got a big roundabout, and they put that big shopping area with more buildings going in. All of that stuff in there is okay because they've done it. They've used, it's all plastic, and they've used fiber optic cables for the charging applications and stuff like that. What we don't want to get into, so that's gone okay, it's a big development. What we don't want to get into is somebody randomly doing something and not being aware of their needs. And therefore, through ignorance, causes the situation to occur. Because most people, if they're a fencer or something, wouldn't naturally think about it. So that's all that's there. It's a catch to make sure that we can have the conversation.
In your evidence, you talk about the EPR hazard zone.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what that's called by?
Correct.
That is?
Correct.
Yes. So I have to help you with it. When I look at this map here,
mm-hmm.
of where your designation is, which is 338, it looks a lot bigger than the designation area that you've shown.
Is right next door to our substation.
Oh, and yours is the bigger. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And this map here is not correct, because we should show you designation of this one. 33. That should be shown on there if it's right next door.
Yeah.
Okay. So yours is only the small bit, and primarily it's going to affect the people to the east. Oh, sorry, on your plan. This one here. The 45 metres is the bit that splits that person's
correct.
Property there.
And
Do they know anything about this at all?
In terms of the proposal?
This request to.
I would need to double check with our landowner liaison officers. There is a tower on their property, so they are normally in that loop.
Right.
But I would need to check that specifically.
So they also will be likely to be aware of the corridor that was notified in the plan.
Because that,
So what's
it? To be honest, I don't think we can rely on somebody's submissions. Takes 2 Eastlights. And they have 10 working days, say the people are aware. They had this discussion with Aurora on their
post. Yes, I think the difference here is that there's a designation that will have been notified to potentially affected parties.
And that designation.
And compared to Aurora's relief, the corridors were notified in the plan itself.
Yes.
But we can confirm whether there's been any specific further dialogue.
Remember, it's only for ongoing works, because everything that's there now is okay. So,
what I was going to ask you about, Ms. McFarlane, in respect to this issue, it seems to me that it's a very limited form of constraint that Transpower is seeking on that area, and it seems more appropriately dealt with through a notice of requirement, because it's... I mean, the council can manage consents on that, but at the end of the day, it's Transpower that needs to be doing the talking to the people, not the council.
Yeah.
And if the council, if the point of it is for Transpower to talk to those people, the designation is the most appropriate, especially as Mr. Benton has described it, it's not taking their land and it's not. It's only limiting the methods they use to do the activities on it. That doesn't strike me as a sort of onerous designation effect. But
no, and I accept what you're saying. I thought you might ask me this question. I have been pondering the difference. I guess one difference is that Transpower holds an absolute right of veto under the designation and the 176 consent, whereas we're not talking about a non-complying consent activity status here, restricted discretionary, limited to those electrical matters. It does give the ability for the council to grant consent. It doesn't leave Transpower as the sole arbiter of what's right and wrong, and it does enable a balance, perhaps, that the council could strike.
Does the council have expertise though? You know, I mean, you're giving it to a land on a 1 year.
I don't disagree with you that a designation.
There's nothing about electrical conductivity.
I don't disagree with you that a designation is a tool that would be available to achieve this.
Mm.
It hasn't been sought in Transpower's
role owners. I'm just exploring because that's...
Yes.
I just know the pressure the consent planners in this district are under, and the sort of planner who is likely to receive an application for this is not going to be one of the senior experienced planners.
No.
It's going to be someone who's come to the district recently, not a lot of experience, and look at them and say, "Oh yeah, that looks okay," and they'll sign it off, and you actually won't be any better off.
Yeah, and I appreciate your comment. I guess my only other observation in relation to the designation versus rules in a plan tool would be how the US decision makers might choose to give effect to the NPS. That may slightly weigh more towards the necessity for a rule as opposed to not. But I agree with you that the designation would be a valid tool to achieve the outcomes Transparent thinking.
Yeah.
Is it thinking aloud in terms of how, if it was possible, if the designation was the way to go, would it, if that was put in, could that then be incorporated into the hearing stream for designations?
No, because that makes no
I'm not finished. What about if you were doing it when it comes to would it be appropriate to do it in the mapping exercise?
That doesn't matter when you put a designation, because those requirement provisions are, no matter when it's heard, once it goes and gets approved by the requiring authority, it goes into both the operative and the those things.
I think probably another matter to contemplate here is some level of complexity about the designation, over-designation matters that would arise here with both, with Transpower seeking to designate over both Aurora and the transport agency.
Presumably Aurora's not such an issue. Well, I understand the problem, I would hope.
You would expect so.
The other question that I was going to ask of you, I'm not sure whether it's completely apparent, but I would have thought putting the pressure on you, Mr. Taylor, it's really the way the rule was written should be quite explicit as to what it's concerning. Is there any reason why it couldn't be permitted subject for certain activities subject to Transpower's approval or a controlled activity with that sort of thing? I'm trying to think of a way that it's not
subject to
the council.
Yes, I think being permitted subject to a third party approval might have sort of legal implications.
Yes.
Yeah,
I'm
supposed to
fix that. Sure. The only key difference perhaps between controlled activity and restricted discretionary activity would be the ability to decline an application for something that would be inappropriate for those electrical reasons.
From what Mr.
Benson
said.
Yeah,
that
typically be designed around.
Yeah, so just north of Lenham, about 150 metres from Lenham substation, there was a person subdividing up their land who was trying to do something that was exactly this type of issue. The council then had a setback, so they came, saw us, and they said, oh, well, yeah, as long as Transpower's okay, go and see them. They came to Saurus, we checked their plans and said as long as you do this, come off that way rather than straight off the it's fine, knock yourself out.
That sounds like a control activity.
Yeah, well, in the absence of any evidence of the need to, of examples or the need to decline a consent, then I'm not in a position to say anything other than I would think that a control activity could achieve the outcomes sought. I would be more than happy to.
Well, it seems that given that we really rely on Mr. Renton's expertise as to the matters that would be affected, it's probably more appropriate for you to have first crack at it than our council officers or ourselves. Clearly, it's a safety issue. There's clear resource management reason for it. It's just a matter of getting the best way of dealing with it.
Yeah, and just like the things with earthworks, it's a matter of effort, making sure somehow we have the conversation so it's all fixed before anybody's having to spend any money doing anything, or before somebody's done something and somebody's got injured. So that's all.
Would you please know that if that initial question, that kind of brings me to what I needed to cover.
I think you already asked all my questions. Do you have any further questions?
Not from Mr. Lincoln, no.
I just thought I'd start briefly with high-level comments on the objectives and policies. Noting that it was my evidence that there's an imbalance in the revised chapter in terms of how the two nationally significant matters that dealt with in chapter 30 are addressed. In my view, the opening purpose statement, the objectives and related policies are more clear in the way in which they elevate and reflect the enabling elements of the National Policy Statement for Renewable Energy and Electricity Generation when compared to the way in which the more generic utilities provisions deal with the national grid. I've suggested in my evidence that two further objectives go some way to resolving this. And also to provide a firmer basis upon which the policies and rules can hang off, if I could use that term. To some extent, I consider that it's not entirely apparent how and which objectives the subsequent policies are implementing, and it may assist in giving effect to the National Policy Statement to include specific reference to the national grid. There are other ways of achieving this, and I have noted that as well in my evidence. I've also agreed with the Section 32 report in terms of the organisation of the objectives and policies insofar as they relate to the utilities could be improved to be more clear and concise. And my comments there are similarly around a contemplation of which objectives are implementing, which policies are implementing which objectives, and just ensuring that they are clear and concise and tightly arranged. And then probably if we go into the details of the objectives and policies of the revised chapter, I gave some thorough consideration to TransPower's submission and in many cases thought that the amendments sought by TransPower weren't necessary, subject to some refinements to four of the policies. The more significant refinements are set out in my evidence to policy 30.2.6.4. And this is to clarify that the policy applies to the national grid only, and I acknowledge that Commissioner Sinclair has had some questions about this policy and what it applies to earlier in the week. I've sought to amend the terminology to better align with that used in the NPS, and that includes the avoid word is used in the NPS. The other amendments I have sought in relation to policy 30.2.7.1, and you will have heard, I've seen in evidence from other parties, similar consideration of whether requiring a reduction of effects is appropriate in regard to linear network utilities, and if that's possible to achieve. I think there's justice for PowerNet and Mr. McCullum Clark, the telecommunications companies, both had similar views that it may be that there needs to be an element of balance and that policy to recognise that reduction won't always be possible, but the benefits of utilities may mean, or the locational requirements may mean, that the utility activity may be appropriate. The last matter in terms of the policies were very minor amendments, just to ensure that the policies that require undergrounding don't apply to the national grid. And the reason for that is that the National Policy Statement clearly does not anticipate or require, it does anticipate, I guess, but doesn't require undergrounding. And my reading of the policies is that they are particularly directed towards the servicing of, for instance, new subdivisions, and that perhaps the policies in 32, 7, 2 and 3 ought to more clearly ensure that those policies don't apply to the national grid.
Is any of the national grid underground in there, Stephen?
Yes, it is.
Yes, we have undergrounding in Kaipoi, we have undergrounding in Wellington, undergrounding in Auckland. Nothing here in the space of this.
Thank you. That's all I really have to say on the Jackson Symposium. I'm happy to take questions about that now. We'll just carry on.
Other than as the objectives and policies are currently framed up, do you I'm trying to understand whether if we separated out that it's the national grid and used that terminology, that would indicate that that's all that those objectives and policies related to, rather than any other utilities that might. Is that what
I've suggested some national grid specific objectives, and I've suggested that policy 30.2.6.4 should be amended to clearly only apply to the national grid. I think that's the intent of that policy in any case. The objectives and policies don't need to be specific to the national grid to give effect to the national policy statement. However, often plan drafters will find it easier to at least include some level of specific objectives and policies that relate to the national grid, because to not do so applies the same level of enablement for a nationally significant national grid to all utilities, unless there's a carve out in some way in the way in which the objectives and policies are drafted, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So if we just move on to the rules, maybe this does address the rules around minor upgrading. And there's also been some questions as to further evidence that you've heard of that in regard to minor upgrading. I just want to note that in terms of the national grid, at least in the near future, it's really unlikely that Transpower would need to rely on the rules that relate to minor upgrading because of the presence of the NES. However, there could come a time, for instance, if a new line were built, that there would be a need to rely on this rule. And I don't want to say too much about it, except for perhaps give you some indication that in some jurisdictions where minor upgrading has been considered, the NES has been useful to consider insofar as minor upgrading relates to electricity, because that has that whole suite of upgrading rules, including regulations of the NES, including those that are permitted. So it helps to understand a rigorously tested cut-off for what's appropriate as a permitted activity versus what might not. So what I'm suggesting is that when you consider that, it may be useful to consider what is permitted in the NES as a cut-off to what might be minor and what might be more than minor. And that's really all I have to say on that, but it is useful, and it certainly was used in the context of Christchurch, where the issue of cut-off between minor and more than minor upgrading was rigorously debated. My evidence also addresses the rules for lines and support structures, and I have suggested in my evidence that the revised chapter has taken an overly stringent approach to lines and support structures, to the extent that no new electricity lines could be built as a permitted activity anywhere at any scale. Now, I know you've dealt with this and particularly considered undergrounding and lines and roads over this week. And similarly, I've suggested in my evidence that perhaps there is an opportunity for a permitted default to control, but and even a default further to a restricted discretionary status for lines. If that there was some differentiation between more sensitive receiving environments and also the height of the lines, often voltage is used as a function of lines, but the reality is voltage has very limited effect on the environment. It's actually the height of the support structure that is the effect that may need to be controlled, and it may be better for a plan to express that in height rather than voltage. Now, probably one of the critical matters in this chapter are the rules that relate to activities, buildings and structures near the national grid transmission lines. In my evidence at paragraph 50, I set out the differences between the rules in the revised chapter and the rules that Transpower sought in submission, and concluded that there are a few gaps. I address each one of those gaps and the need for them to be closed in order to give effect to policies 10 and 11. And in my evidence, I've proposed a revised non-complying rule. So it has the effect of perhaps flipping the approach taken in the plan and having a presumption of non-complying activity status in the National Grid yard, but then having a number of exemptions to that non-complying activity status, as opposed to the other way around, which is these few things are permitted and everything else is not complying. Currently, sort of, from what I understand of practice across the country, it's a little bit of a 50-50 approach to that. When I gave evidence in Christchurch, Transpower submission initially sort of permitted activity with a default for most activities to non-complying, and it was suggested in questioning from the various panel there that perhaps I was supporting a Clayton's permission activity rule. So I have given some thought to whether in fact non-complying is better with exceptions, and suggested that in my evidence here. Now, Commissioner Sinclair had some questions about sensitive activities earlier, I think, from Mr. Barr this week. I have suggested that activities need to be covered in these rules because Policy 11 of the National Policy Statement deals specifically with sensitive activities generally not being provided for in the National Grid Yard. The revised chapter, or the definitions, includes the definition for National Grid sensitive activities. And I've suggested some limited amendments to that definition, but in the most part, it's my conclusion that definition matches or is consistent with the definition of in the National Policy Statement, and that captures the types of activities as opposed to buildings and structures that would be regulated in the National Grid Yard.
And for those amended National Grid sensitive activities at the end of your...
Yes, and unfortunately I've changed it to look like I made all those changes, but a number of those come through in the revised chapter. I think it's the preamble.
The colour underlined is yours.
The red is mine, however, there is an error in my evidence in relation to that, and from memory, the amendments I suggested to that definition when compared to the revised chapter was a deletion of a lot of the preamble about the electrical effects, because I consider that unnecessary.
Do they match the existing definitions as they are now in the plan? They all match up?
There was a submission that said these don't match up with what. Obviously, Transpower have come in and not given any thought to the district plan, and I've done a check against the other definitions in the plan to make sure that there's alignment between sensitive activities as defined in the National Policy Statement and how those sensitive activities are defined in the district plan to ensure that the safe family of activities is captured. Now, I'll turn briefly again to earthworks, but just very briefly, because I think we've covered the definition matter. I have suggested some other amendments to the earthworks National Grid Yard Rules 30.5.11. The first one is to delete include. I think that include, using the word include in a rule is uncertain. And I think those exclusions just turn to the rule. Those exclusions need to be more clearly set out because it's a rule. If that makes so 30.5.11 on page 30.18. The revised proposal, revised chapter has included include. Now the other amendments I have proposed to Rule 30.5.11, delete the provisions that relate to pole support structures on the basis there are none in Queenstown Lakes District, and therefore those rules are unnecessary. I've also refined the terminology to better reflect the terminology in SCP 34. The last thing I've done is suggested that the non-compliant status be non-compliant, and the reason for that is that these provisions in the most part mirror SCP 34 and are similar to, I think it's section 237 of the Public Works Act. On that basis, earthworks that don't achieve these standards are unlikely to be lawful in any case. So to default to discretionary is perhaps misleading to a plan user. There may be some expectation that the use is anticipated in some circumstances. The reality is the use ought to be not anticipated.
The only question I had on that rule that you drafted, and I presume it's your drafting, was the exemption in 11.5. And I wonder why buildings or structures associated with water storage are somehow different from other buildings and structures.
Do you want to comment on irrigation? Typically, network utilities, I was going to use the term kind of symbiotic relationship with the national grid. That is not the same for irrigation, storage, and the conveying of water for irrigation. Do you want to speak about the effects?
Well, I suppose the first question is there a network utility operator in this district that stores water or uses irrigation purposes other than the district council?
I'm not aware, but I wouldn't want to.
I wouldn't want to prejudge
the next 10 years.
Yeah, but for like somebody who's wanting to expand, irrigation for their vineyards or something like that. You need to build a bit of water storage reticulation, put a dam up behind somewhere and run some pipes across the...
It has to be a network utility
operator.
How does
that work? Because I'm outside my depth here. How does that work if, you know, two or three vineyards got together and, you know, like, because we see these types of things popping up, say, in North Canterbury, with
The smaller scale irrigation company.
Yeah, that's it. But they become their own little company and then they're running pipes
pipelines across the countryside, or so NOIC is a good example, Northern Target Irrigation
Company. Yes, and other states, there's quite a few of them in Canterbury.
And it has been an issue that has reared its head in the Canterbury context.
That's a challenge, yes. But if you look up, say, I know it's not here, but if you just look towards Wanaka with the amount of people putting things in irrigation, they're kind of thinking that, we're tracking our electricity consumption in these areas going well.
Yes, Laura told us yesterday that
it won't be too far long before they put an NGSP in up around Wanaka at 220.66 or something to accommodate.
That's why you're just looking at the power usage from irrigation as far as seeds, anything that's likely to come from tourism.
It's quite interesting. Whether or not that reflects into here is a completely different story, but you do see an intensification of things going on.
The question is there less problem with the earthworks done by someone who is putting irrigation in their structures than there is other people doing earthworks? Just the rule seems to say that there is less of a problem from my reading of it. I might be reading it wrong, but
the rule saying that earthworks and network utilities are exempt, except for where those network utilities are irrigation related.
Right. Okay.
And the reason for that.
So now I understand.
It's the other way around.
I've drafted that differently. That's.
Sorry. Yes. They're not the most straightforward provisions.
Yes.
So the issue is that compared to other network utilities, dams and the earthworks associated with irrigation can be quite substantial and don't really fit the same way with perhaps a directionally drilled fibre optic cable.
That's good.
Now, I just want to briefly speak about Aurora's line setbacks. I have some concerns in relation to the terminology used and also the extent of regulation when compared to the regulation for the National Grid. The first matter is I don't support the use of the term sub-transmission. Transpower's initial submission suggested that critical electricity lines being defined to exclude the National Grid was not the appropriate definition, and I appreciate that the 42A report has suggested that sub-transmission might be a resolution to that. I don't support that term either. And the reason for that is that transmission is a term used by the National Policy Statement and the National Environmental Standard that both relate to the National Grid only. The transmission is in the title of those documents, and my concern is that a layperson using the NPS or the NES or considering an Aurora line versus a Transpower line may be more confused by the sub-transmission transmission, just, what is what, and certainly a layperson can't tell on the ground whether they're looking at a sub-transmission or a transmission line, typically. The sub-transmission might be the electrical engineering term in the truest sense, but my preference is to rely on the term distribution, and that's based on the fact that this is the term that Orion have used in the context of the Christchurch plan. It's also the term that Mainpower had sought to use in the Hiranui plan. And that's as broad as the precedent gets so far, but I think probably consistency has some merit. Using the term distribution or identified distribution lines also deals with the non-sub-transmission line, which is the Wanaka to Makarora line that Aurora and the council consider a region as significant as well. Now my second concern in relation to the relief sought by Aurora is that in some cases the extent of restriction Aurora is seeking is greater than the restriction sought by Transpel, and I consider that quite a perverse outcome that nationally significant infrastructure has lesser protection than regionally significant infrastructure. And I also note that in both cases, the protection afforded by the rules in the revised chapter is more stringent than ECP 34. And I think Mr. Regent's probably demonstrated some of the things that may be allowed by ECP 34 that would be restricted or regulated by the rules proposed in the plan. Now, some examples of the more stringent nature that may assist you is that Ms. Dow was suggesting a 32-metre corridor for subdivision for all of Aurora's identified sub-transmission or distribution lines. Transpower is seeking a 32-metre corridor, as Mr. Renton explained, to deal with the maximum conductive, to reach that point of maximum wind conditions conductive swing. Where the line is of a smaller voltage, the conductive swing is less.
The spans are much.
And the spans are less, so, well, and that's the driver. So in that situation, Aurora actually seeking quite a broad extent of regulation when compared to Transpower's, because they're going well beyond where the maximum wind conditions conductive swing is.
Presumably it's lower voltage too. The distance from the end of the swing is less.
Yeah, and the same thing applies in terms of the 10-metre corridor for conductive swing in everyday conditions. I think that's probably close to, Mr. Renton, correct me if I'm wrong, for 66 kV, but it's well beyond what you might expect for conductive swing at 33 or 11 kV. So again, that's greater regulation that is being sought by Transpower. Another example is that the rules for the national grid, or in favour of the national grid, allow for certain types of rural buildings within the yard. And they're like hay sheds that meet NZETP 34. There are situations where Transpower's rules would provide for accessory buildings of that kind of thing to be constructed under the lines without triggering the non-complying rule. That differs to the rule sought by Aurora that restricts all buildings that need a building consent within 10 metres. So Aurora's rule creates a more sterile corridor, if you like, compared to Transpower, and thus is more restrictive. The last matter I wanted to just raise is the rules that Aurora is seeking to control tree planting within 20 metres of distribution lines. Once again, this goes beyond the restrictions for the national grid. Transpower's position has been advice notes around the electricity hazards for trees regulations. That just advises you to be careful what you plant under here because they're going to be cut, basically. Select your plants carefully, manage them to meet the electricity hazards for trees regulations, as opposed to say you can't plant here. In my opinion, restricting planting by a rule of the plan probably goes beyond what those regulations seek to achieve. Those regulations don't say you can't plant, they say manage your tree.
I raise the matter of potential for double regulation.
Yes, and potentially it does reduce the cost to the line owner. If there are no trees there, then you don't need to go and inspect them or trim them or send trim notices. So I'm sure Transpower would be very happy to have a it goes beyond what is accepted practice, and certainly what the regulatory regime established under the Electricity Act seeks to achieve. Now my last matter really is just to deal with the planning maps, and we've identified one issue, the designation not being shown on planning map 33. Similarly, policy 12 of the NPS requires the national grid to be shown on all planning maps, and I just note planning map 31 doesn't have the transmission line shown on it either. So that's important. It's also important, should the distribution lines be mapped, for plan users, and in terms of the way in which the policies may unfold, I think it's really important that there's a clear distinction in the mapping between the national grid, as is required under policy 12 of the NPS, and any distribution lines using colours or keys or something like that. Now, my last point. You'll recall in the subdivision hearing, the Section 42A report suggested, and I fully support the suggestion, that the rules that relate to the subdivision corridor, the national grid, be taken out of the utilities chapter and put in the subdivision chapter. I strongly supported that approach because I think the plan users, the people who are affected by those provisions, aren't going to go to the network utilities chapter to see if they need to do anything special for their subdivision. And I wonder whether a similar approach may be beneficial in relation to these third-party activities that are regulated by the rules that currently sit in Chapter 13.
Such as earthworks
and the building structure sensitive activities in the National Grid Yard. My preference is that rules like that are best sitting in the zone where the plan users who are affected by those rules can easily find them and understand them, as opposed to them preparing their resource consent application, turning up at the council for their pre-application meeting and being told there's a restriction that they didn't know about because they didn't turn to the utilities chapter, which can inadvertently lead to costs if in fact there was a building designed in a way that would trigger the non-complying activity status. So that's something that I just suggest and ask that you be mindful of in making your decision. I think that's all I have today. Thank you for your time.
Mr. McLeod's current board is one that I had, so in terms of...
Just one thing on the definition of transmission or sub-transmission. Aurora are correct, technically, as an engineering point of view, governed by voltages internationally. The trick with that, though, is you really need to focus on what the function is, because Vector, for example, has transmission voltages, they have 110 kV, but they're using them in a distribution context. So I know we're getting slightly fanatic about words. It's technically correct, yes, but they're using it, say, Vector's case, at the distribution level. So let's support Ainsley's approach that we do need to be careful with what is the function it's being used for, because an engineer will read it one way, but in reality we're trying to write this for people who are lay people and being able to say this is a distribution asset to use to pick power up from a whole point and take it to your houses and businesses. Everyone understands the concept of distribution rather than sub-transmission. Well, we better go and talk to transparent or leave and say ours.
Any questions? No, I think we've covered everything. Mm-hmm. The one thing is that I've asked you to keep it having a wording with that.
The controlled activity rules and substation.
Any chance you can get that back to Mr. Barr by end of tomorrow?
No problem at all. I know where to find him.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I will really do that too. Thank you.